And now the Stanford Storytelling Project presents as a special addendum to the show Animal Kingdom 2, an interview with Eric Puchner.
My name is Lee Constantino, and I'm here today with Eric Puchner, talking to him about his short story, Animals Here Below. I'd like to start, Eric, by asking you how you came to write this story. If you could tell us a little bit about the story of the story, that would be great.
Basically, the idea, I mean, if I can remember correctly, it's been a while, but someone told me a story, a friend of mine told me a story about their friend's roommate who was incredibly attached to her dog, and I think it was a Bichon Frise or something. I don't remember exactly what kind of dog it was. Anyway, the dog died, and she was so attached to it that she decided to send the dog's head to a renderer who was going to sort of taxidermy, clean the skull so she could keep it as a keepsake, and this would mean a lot to her. And I'd never heard of such a thing. And the reason that my friend's friend was a little – actually, they ended up getting married eventually, but the reason that he was a little traumatized, that the renderer wasn't around, was on vacation, so they actually had to keep the dog in the freezer for a while. So friends of his would come over, and there'd be a dog in their freezer, and I thought, wow, if that isn't good material, I don't know what is. So I hopped on the internet, and I did some research, and I found out all about this whole world of rendering skulls, and there is a whole world out there, and I became drawn into it and fascinated by it, especially because they use these things called dermistid beetles, which clean the skull. And anyway, that was sort of the genesis of the story, that image. And then I don't know how I made the leap to it actually being a story about kids and a missing parent and all that stuff. But
yeah, I mean, that's what's interesting. You take the dog and the dog's skull, and it becomes a kind of central prop or pivot around which a lot of the, you know, drama of the story happens, right? A lot of the mix-ups and confusions are built around, you know, built around that skull. And so from sort of a technique perspective, that's very interesting. How did you sort of, you know, decide on that? Like, how did you decide to use, you know, how to use that?
Well, I didn't really. I mean, I just often when I begin a story, I just have a central image or sometimes just a situation. Occasionally it's comic. And I build from that, and the characters begin to create themselves. And so that's what happened with this story. I honestly don't remember. I think I you know, that was the genesis of it, the original idea, that image of the skull and the dog in the freezer. And I also, as I started writing it, I became really interested in this idea of someone who would have been left by his spouse and sort of fall in love with the family dog as sort of a surrogate wife. And that became compelling and funny and very sad to me and tragic. And so and then this whole idea of animals, these animals kept popping up in the story, and then more animals, and then they go to the Desert Museum, which is filled with animals, and it sort of became a story about our relationship with animals in a way too, and how sort of troubled it is in some
ways. There are a lot of other references to animals in this story and in other stories as well. And specifically in terms of props, this is something I'm fascinated by, you know, how stories can get built around different props and how you move them around and they can move a plot forward. So the mother's hair is another prop that I'm totally fascinated by, especially because it sort of, the cutting of the mother's hair becomes a kind of, it sort of underscores the irony. You know, Caitlin is finally, she's cutting something. She's contributing to the plot in some way, the plot to keep the mother there and to have them, you know, fall in love again. I'm sort of wondering, and the hair is constantly, you know, compared to a snake and to other other animal figures. Could you talk a little bit about the mother's hair?
Yeah, the hair, the final image of her bringing the hair in, which is a surprise, I hope, to the reader, but makes sense in terms of what's come before. I didn't arrive at it the first draft. That took a couple drafts before I arrived at that. I was very stumped about the ending until I forced myself to wake up very early one morning and got out of bed when it was still dark and just started writing whatever popped into my mind, and I think that's how I arrived at that at the ending. The mother's hair, which is threaded throughout and actually begins the story, is actually from the idea of these kids touching this person's hair, this sort of mother that they haven't seen in a while, was actually something that came to me from a Sufjan Stevens song, which is I like quite a bit. And there's a line in there about touching our mother's hair, and that sort of spawned the beginning of the story for me. Music is often sort of an inspiration to me. I'll take a line that intrigues me and see if I can build a whole story about it.
Does it affect your style too? Do you find like sort of musical cadences, and do you think musically when you write?
Yeah, I do. And that's a really good question. Nobody's ever asked me that before. Definitely. I mean, I'm really compelled by voice, and it's often how I begin a story, just by coming up with a voice that I've never used before. And that's what interests me. Mm-hmm. And that has everything to do with music and cadence. And I think this kid has a very idiosyncratic sort of voice to him, I hope. It's tough to write stories about kids and make them compelling to an adult reader. And you can do it in various ways, but one way I think is to create a voice that's compelling and musical in that way.
So, like, a lot of the effect also comes from the sort of the readers having a certain kind of knowledge that the kid doesn't have, and having a sort of maybe even a different relationship to the parents, I think. And the mother is presented in a much more positive light at first, and then the father seems like this sort of dejected, unemployed, loserish figure, but their positions really shift by the end. And I was wondering, was that a conscious choice that you made? And how did you try to craft that into what you were doing?
Yeah, that was definitely a conscious choice. That was a movement of the story for me, would be this sort of, the two parents are counterpoint to each other. And what I wanted was that sort of shift in allegiance, and both, from the boy's perspective, but also from the reader's perspective. So that was definitely conscious.
Another sort of related question on the mother and the father. Your title comes from this prayer that the father utters. And there is a kind of recurring reference to ESP, the mother's apparent sense of her own psychic abilities. And I imagine the mother is this kind of hippie, countercultural type drifting around to different sort of medium-sized cities around the country. But I'm interested in this sort of the role of spirituality and religion in the story and how you sort of see that, those, as themes and as things you're interested in writing about.
I'm not religious and I don't go to church, but I seem to keep trying in a lot of my stories to have this moment that's almost, a quote-unquote spiritual moment that occurs. And but since I'm not actually a believer, it's something that's perhaps because it's missing from my life, I try to capture it in the stories that I write. But there's another story in the book, the final story called Mission, which also has a moment which, someone might call it a sort of like secular spiritual moment or something. And those moments interest me. It has a lot to do with just these moments of, there's Joyce's whole idea of the epiphany.
Yeah, exactly.
But these moments of illumination and stillness and beauty, which have a sort of spiritual effect on the characters and the reader, and that's something that I'm really interested in. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they're overtly religious.
No, but it definitely brought me into the mindset of thinking about Joyce and also thinking about the short story as a form.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned you were writing a novel now. I'm curious, do you find that your relationship to the novel is different? The listeners won't have read or know anything about the novel, but what's the difference in the craft? Clearly the stories are organized around these epiphanic moments. Is it different, do you find, with the novel?
Oh, yeah, it's very different. In some ways, it's been really liberating. I love writing short stories because short stories are sort of all about singleness of effect. You can call it an epiphanic moment. I don't think my stories necessarily have epiphanic moments in terms of the characters coming to great revelations. But there is a moment that's epiphanic perhaps for the reader, and it is about building to this sort of singleness of effect, which I think great short stories do. Louis Menand in the New Yorker, he was reviewing some collection, I don't remember what, but he called it the whoa moment, where you just go, whoa, and that's what a short story can do. When this novel is totally different. You're living with these characters for years, and I really, when I'm writing my novel, I'm really trying not to do what some story writers, I think, do when they move on to write a novel, which is have each chapter almost like a discrete story, which has its own whoa moment and everything. I'm really trying to write a novel.
Build an arc and all
that stuff. And one chapter leads into the next and, maybe even has a cliffhanger and that sort of thing. So it's been totally different for me. Writing a novel is probably the hardest thing I've ever done. Mm-hmm. But it's also been liberating for me as a writer. There's more time, and mm-hmm. you can be more leisurely in terms of your exposition.
Does reading the story make you see it differently? Does it play differently than you imagined when you were writing it? And does thinking about reading stories out loud feed back into the process of writing and composition?
Well, I have to be honest, you know, when I'm reading a story and there's no audience in front of me, it's almost like gibberish. I mean, I might as well be reading anything. I don't pay attention to what the sentences actually mean when I'm reading them, but I do pay attention to the rhythm and the cadence of it. But when you get up and read it, something that you've written in front of an audience and they're responding directly to it, yes, it has a huge impact. People laugh at parts that you didn't think were particularly funny, and don't laugh at the parts that you thought were hilarious when you'd written it. It's always really interesting to hear what people respond to, and even when they're not laughing, you know, sometimes people will gasp at something that you've written, and you're like, "What? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?" So yeah, no, and I always read my stuff out loud all the time. I mean, my wife can hear me down the hall. You know, it's an incredibly important part of the composition process to me, just on a sentence by sentence level. Mm-hmm. I have to hear what they sound like to hear if they sound good or not.
Yeah. Do you find that, like, say, interiority or other elements of character don't play as well when you read them out loud?
Definitely.
Yeah.
That's why when I often am doing a reading, I'll choose something that is, you know, comic or funny. And often is sort of dialogue-centric, just because that plays well, particularly if there are a lot of other readers. It's a long reading.
Right.
I mean, people have limited attention spans. It's very different. Yeah, I mean, if I were to choose a sample of my work that I felt was most representative, it probably would be both interior and dialogue-driven. Mm-hmm. So, I definitely choose accordingly.
Were you conscious of Animals Down Below as a music through the floor story rather than as just something you were producing?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't writing it for the... I mean, I was writing it for the collection. I wanted it to be in the collection.
Right.
But I didn't think of these stories as being part of a bigger picture of being more than just the sum of their parts. So it's been fascinating to me. First of all, I was surprised it could even sell the collection because they're so diverse, you know, stylistically even.
Essay number three is, you know...
Right, something totally different. So... I think, though, as writers, we often think our stuff is really different, you know, from one piece to the next. But when an outside reader looks at it and say, I mean, it's been interesting to read the reviews that it's gotten. People have seen these overarching themes. And, you know, one person, one of the two sort of not terrific reviews I got said that the stories were too similar, and that shocked me. When I sit down to write a short story, I think of it as sort of a discrete entity, but it heartens me that these themes that I'm not even aware of, I mean, they're subconscious, keep coming up over and over again.
Yeah. So. It's sort of like mass market psychoanalysis, right? Everyone is telling you what your concerns are after
right,
the fact, right?
It's good. I'll take it.
Yeah.
I can't afford therapy.
Great.
All right. That was great.
Special presentation brought to you by AZSU and the Stanford Storytelling Project.